What's up, everyone, and welcome to the Impact Michigan podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Abad, and I am really excited that you're either watching or listening to this show. This show is about the people making the growth and development of Michigan's economy happen. Entrepreneurs, investors, innovators, public figures, you name it. If they make stuff happen, they've been on or will be on this show. Before we get into things, I wanted to invite you to support this podcast through my Patreon account, which you can find at www.patreon, that's patreon.com/LeanneAbad. If you don't know what Patreon is, it's essentially a way for creators to be supported by their most dedicated fans. And I would hope that's you. So if you're interested in more of this content and helping me make this thing sustainable, check it out. Here's a word from our sponsors. A special thank you to WeWork for providing the studio to record this podcast right here in downtown Detroit. Head to we.co/podcastdetroit to learn more about WeWork. This interview was recorded as part of Detroit Startup Week, which is a week-long celebration of entrepreneurship in the Detroit region. Check out the festivities at www.detroitstartupweek.com. All right, with that, let's get into the episode. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here again. It's amazing.
Awesome. Okay, so I always just like to start my podcast interviews off by allowing the listeners to just get a sense, get a feel, and really just get to know my guest. So for the listeners, who is Chris Thomas?
So I am a husband and a father and a resident of the city of Detroit. I live about six blocks from where we are right now on Campus Martius. I'm a native of Detroit, born in Marquette. We were talking earlier before we kicked off, very working class upbringing in Waterford, Michigan, public schools all the way through. I went to Michigan State undergrad, degrees in economics and international relations from both James Madison and the Social Science School. And then I became every young man's dream, an investment banker in San Francisco. And I gained about 30 pounds and I worked 100 hours a week. But I learned a tremendous amount. And I was lucky. I had internships before I took the full-time job. I worked in Europe for the Michigan Jobs Commission and a variety of other positions. But I did that for 2 years, technology investment banking with UBS in their sell side platform in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So lots of IPOs, follow-ons, pipes, great deal experience, a lot of just great work experience. And then very unexpectedly, when the war in Iraq kicked off in 2003, I joined the U.S. Army. And my youngest brother gave me a call, said, Chris, war's on. This is our generation's war. He was at Western Michigan at the time. He said, I'm going to drop out of school. I'm going to join the Army. I'm going to be an artilleryman. I'm going to go to the war. And I said, Scott, I love you. I'm proud of you. You know, nation needs great leaders. And I hung up the phone, and I sat at my Excel model for about 10 minutes, and I called him back at like 10 at night in San Francisco and said, I'm going to do this with you. So long story short, suit and tie, I went down to the recruiting office, joined the U.S. Army. 4 months later, was in boot camp at Knox, infantry officer school at Benning, was branched to communications officer, went to Fort Gordon, also in Georgia, and then I went straight to the war. So did 1 year in Iraq, north of Baghdad, a place called El Fa, was communications officer, finished up on the east coast of the United States at Fort Meade, Maryland, as a training officer, and then was accepted to Yale, which is, we both know, given our previous conversation, is a long way away from Waterford, Michigan. But an amazing experience, and the reason I went there was because the mantra for the Yale School of Management, where I got my MBA, is educating leaders for business and society. So it's about doing great things in business, but it's about how do those things impact your community positively. And whether that's your neighborhood, whether that's your city, whether that's your state, whether that's your country or the world, you know, whatever you want it to be. But I wanted that to be a key component of why I was going back to school, to make sure I could impact the world around me, my family, my friends, my community in a positive way. And I knew I wanted to come back to Detroit. So again, long story short, in between your first and second year of business school, you always have an internship. And I went to the career development office and said, I'm really excited to go to Detroit. And this was, mind you, 2008. And they said, you know, wait a minute, do you want to go to London or Singapore or LA or New York? And I was like, no, I want to go to Detroit. And they're like, well, good luck to you. You know, go ahead and apply. And I applied to about 40 positions, and I got a job at Ford Treasury, which I thought would be this fantastic internship. 60 hours a week, learn a bunch, jump back in with a great group here. I showed up, and the U.S. auto industry was imploding. So it was not at all what I expected. But my second day on the job, I reached out to every C-level executive at the firm, and I said the same thing. I'd love a half an hour of your time to talk about why you're here, where this company's going, and what questions should I be asking that I just don't know enough to ask. And because they were all very nice Midwesterners, and because I was the Michigan State Yale kid, they're like, sure, let's have lunch, let's have coffee. So one of the people I reached out to was Bill Ford. Said the same thing to his secretary, and in a little less than 2 weeks on the job, got a call in my cube. Hey, Chris, this is Bill. I got your message. I got half an hour. Can you come upstairs? And I was like, yes, Mr. Ford, I can. So I ran upstairs, and he comes out of his office, doesn't know me from Adam. Nice as can be. You know, Chris, great to meet you. Appreciate your pluck. Tell me how much you love your internship. And I said, well, Mr. Ford, I hate my internship, and here's why. And he laughed at me. He's like, well, we still have 29 more minutes. You know, come to my office. Let's talk. And we have a nice enough conversation, at the end of which he's like, you know, nice to meet you, son. Yeah. Have a good summer. But he shook my hand, and he said, let me know if there's anything I can do for you. And I held his handshake, and I said, there is, Mr. Ford. You can put me on the most interesting project at the company. And he looks at me, and he said, what's that? I said, I have absolutely no idea, sir, but I know you do. And so he laughed at me again. He said, have a nice weekend. I came back on Monday, and the guy who I was reporting to just hated that I was taking all these meetings. He's like, get your stuff, go report to Mr. Ford. So I go upstairs, and he's like, I thought about it. I'm going to transfer you down to a group focused on the future of transportation in megacities over 10 million. Let me tell you about it. There's no budget. Skunkworks group. No people that are on it full time, like 25% time. Come back in a week and tell me what you see. And that meeting became a weekly meeting. Mr. Ford became Bill. And this earnest discussion around the future of mobility was fostered in 2008. So at the end of the summer, myself and a colleague from Yale, we went to Bill and said, we want to found a firm in this new space we're calling next generation mobility. Mm-hmm. And he goes, great, what do you want to found? And we're like, we have no idea. But we see the demographic trends. We see the technology trends. And to his credit, he goes, well, how can I help? We said, call our dean, ask her to let us do this. She did. We jumped in. We built a lot of really bad business plans for 6 months. We built, you know, hardware, software, consultancy, manufacturing, not good business plans. But through that ideation process, we came to the thesis that there needed to be a firm focused uniquely on investing in mobility where there weren't any. Billions deployed for clean tech, wind, solar, battery, many of which flamed out. Nobody focused on mobility. And the way that we define it is the movement of goods, people, and services empowered by technology, very broadly. Took that back to Bill. He goes, great, love it, put together the analysis. Myself and Chris Cheever, who runs our Boston operation, did an analysis around 300 companies, narrowed it to our top 30, brought in two other founding members of our team, and said, gentlemen, with your dollars that we will spend and you know, our commitment to you that we want to put our careers into this space, we want to found the first firm in the world investing uniquely in mobility. And Bill, to his credit again, said, we'll give you guys a little bit of rope, a little bit of capital, we'll see what you can do. Fast forward to today, almost 10 years later from that initial discussion when I was an intern at Ford, actually exactly 10 years to the day. We have 40 plus companies around the globe. We've invested $200+ million in everything from technologies or entrepreneurs that are impacting road, rail, bike, air, autonomous land, air, and sea system and component layers of those systems, and then seminal horizontal technologies, so AI, big data analytics, differentiated opportunities across holistic robotics, but everything within mobility. And we've done it from here in Detroit. So what my story is one, I like to say it's a great American story, but it's one in which my firm exists because of a very forward-thinking billionaire and a young working-class kid who wanted to just run, and a great team that's come together to form something very special. And we've done it here. And so I love Detroit. I love the state of Michigan. I wear it on my sleeve all day long. I'm proud to have, you know, been able to serve as a military officer, but also now as a civilian with my family and with my community here, serve Detroit, serve Michigan, and happy to be here.
Yeah, gosh, there's a lot that I want to get into there, but our time is limited, so I'm going to keep it to the very, very, I almost said personal stuff, but that's not exactly what I mean. I really mean at the end of the day, I want people to get to know Chris Thomas more. So
I apologize to advance to all everyone listening. So
so in that soliloquy, we'll call it, what happened? So I want to dig deep into the psychology of, so your brother calls you.
Yeah.
You wish him luck. Hang up the phone. Go back to your Excel modeling. And then call him back 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
What went on within those 10 minutes? What was going on in the brain of Chris Thomas?
So I was, it's a great question. It's not a question I get very often. I was thinking about where my brother was going. And he was enlisting. And I knew that he was going to be in a position where he was following the orders he was given to succeed in the mission. And maybe I didn't put it quite in those words, you know, prior to my military service. But then I thought a lot about who's going to be leading him. And I came back to this thought that I kept coming back to all within that 10-minute span around, well, I have an opportunity to lead. This is an opportunity for me to go forward. And while I wouldn't be able to lead my brother, he joined the National Guard, I joined the Federal Service, I could lead men and women like him. And I felt not only a responsibility, but a calling to do that. And I saw my brother, you know, when he shipped out, when he was with Michigan National Guard, he was retrained as a military policeman after being trained as an artilleryman. And then I had a chance to serve in my capacity as an officer with amazing men and women from all walks of life around the country. But in that 10-minute segment, I just kept coming back to who's going to lead Scott and what could I do to have an impact. And the thing that was most amazing, sometimes you hear that the military is kind of the last refuge of scoundrels. Mm. It's a place where people go when there's nowhere else to go. I couldn't disagree more. You know, in basic training, you have truly the whole country. You know, men and women from all walks of life rolling around the mud, where you learn we're all the same when we're rolling around the mud. But in my OCS class, Officer Candidate School, a group of around 30 men and women, I had myself, who was Michigan State undergrad, working class, but just graduated, or rather just left investment banking. I had a guy that was Harvard undergrad, Yale Law, left his law firm in Manhattan. His family almost disowned him. I had a guy, UCLA undergrad, Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, was working on the Hill. William and Mary grad, Harvard undergrad, and then a lot of great sergeants, men and women that were enlisted, that were coming into the officer corps because they were promoted based on merit. But at that moment in time, you had this amazing group of men and women that came together because they felt like it was their duty to do so. And I was one of them. I was one of those people who just felt compelled at that moment to serve. And I owe my brother, you know, a great debt of gratitude. Would I have done that without him? I don't know. But in those 10 minutes, it changed my life.
Yeah. And so I also want to dig into, you know, what about you allowed you to take the initiative to not only call up or email the C-level execs at Ford your first week in your internship, but even call up Bill Ford himself? Like, has that just been part of you since you were, you know, growing up in your formative years, or was that something you learned in, I assume the answer is no, but was that something you learned in business school to just go for as high up as you can go?
So that's a fascinating question, because I was actually taught the exact opposite. I remember being in this class around, like, I don't know what it was called, like engagement and networking, mm-hmm. or one of these classes you take while at business school. And they were like, you know, you want to make sure you're being gradual, you want to make sure you're engaging at the right point, you want to make sure that you're understanding what the system is. And my whole life has been the opposite of that. Like, I've worked, you know, my age is teenage, well, 12 to early 20s. You know, I was a window washer, I cleaned industrial garages, I was a janitor, I was a teller at a credit union, I did fire demo, I had internships on Wall Street. I hustled, and I did what, you know, both paid the most and was a good experience to move on to the next thing. But in every stage, I've always ran after an opportunity, not necessarily something that would give me a job, but just gave me a chance to interview. And so one great example, I was working as a Senate page in Lansing when I was at Michigan State my freshman year. And they give you these great polyester jackets and vests, and you look fantastic in this polyester outfit. But I saw at the time Governor Engler walking through the Senate chamber. He was a former state senator. And I was, like, literally, I was delivering soup to somebody. I was, like, passing out, like, papers or dropping off lunch. And I saw him go through, and I'm like, I want to meet the governor. So I ran out down the hallway and down the stairs when they were still open on the Capitol steps. and I yelled out, "Mr. Governor." And this statey who was with him kind of like, you know, put his hand on his holster of his weapon. And they're like, "Whoa." And I'm like, "Hey, how are you, sir? I just want to introduce myself." And I walked up to him. I said, "Chris Thomas, pleasure to meet you." And he's like, "Well, I see you're a Senate page." I'm like, "Yeah, well, how could you tell? You know, of course I am in this outfit." And he goes, "Well, what do you go to school?" And I started telling him, and I said, "I went to James Madison at Michigan State." And he goes, "Well, where are you doing your international experience?" Because he was also alum. Mm-hmm. And I said, "I've been writing the ambassador to France, but she just passed away in a very freak accident, and I don't know what I'm going to do this summer." He goes, "Well, I think we have an office in Paris. Would you like to go there?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I would." Wow. And he goes, "Call this woman and tell her we had this conversation, and we'll see what we can do." So I run back to like the phone on the wall back. This was in the early 90s or mid 90s, late 90s, and I called this woman. She no way believed the story. She said, "I'll call you back tomorrow." She called me back. She said, "I spoke to the governor. He didn't indeed say this to you. We don't have an office in Paris. We have an office in Brussels. Mm. I'll offer you a non-paid internship. You have to take it right now." And I said, "I'll take it." And I worked my butt off the rest of that year to save money so that I could go do this thing. I ate bologna sandwiches every day, all summer long. But that was an example of, I've always reached out and had this conversation. And I have the privilege of, I'm not a board member, I'm a senior advisor to an organization called the Commit Foundation. And it helps mostly special forces, but a lot of amazing men and women who have gone through the military who are exiting after 20, 30-year careers, transition to civilian life. And I always tell those guys, I'm like, you know, when you go into these situations, don't be cocky, but be confident. Yeah. Like, you know, all of us have something very special to bring. And the other thing I always found is, like, when I was in the halls of Ford or when I was in those situations running after a public servant, which maybe I shouldn't have been doing, you know, those guys usually aren't engaged. You know, women in those situations, they just aren't used to necessarily having those kind of conversations. So just try. And the other thing is, I've been told no a lot. I was kicked off Warren Buffett's driveway once, and I was told no. And that's okay. But I would always rather ask in a confident, respectful way that hopefully makes that conversation happen.
Yeah, how do you balance, because you know, a lot of my friends we like to be ambitious. We like to try sure. and take initiative like that. But how do you balance, you know, being politely respectful, polite and respectful, and at the same time persistent? Politely persistent, I think, is the way I've heard it been put. But then coming off a little too, like, where's the fine line that you draw?
So I always, and I've done this ever since I was a kid, but I've always tried to reverse it and say, if I was this person, and it's really difficult, especially when you're coming up, like you don't really understand that person's, you know, job or just how busy they are. They're trying to balance family and work, and there's so many things that are going on. But I've always tried to reverse it and say, okay, what if I was that man, if I was that woman, what would I want someone to say to me? And so you want to make sure you're being steady. You don't want to overwhelm them with emails or something every day. You want to make sure you're having those check-ins. You want to make sure you're being concise, you know, that you're being very clear about what you're asking. You don't need to write a treatise because no one's going to read that. But, you know, but write a couple sentences or a paragraph that gets your point across. And you want to be genuine. And so one example I would give, and this isn't mine, but I recently had an entrepreneur who has engaged me again and again and again. But he does so probably every 2 weeks. I'm confident he hasn't marked down his calendar. You know, he writes a very, very thoughtful message as to where they are. He says, "I understand, you know, your pipeline is huge. You're very focused on a variety of other things in your portfolio. But I know you mentioned you're going to be in San Francisco. Could we meet? I'd be happy to meet anytime you want." So this guy, and I'd met with him probably 2 years ago. It's been this long conversation. But this happened probably 4 or 5 months ago. This email came in, and I said, "You know what? I'm going to take breakfast with this guy." Because he's concise, because he's respectful, and because he is passionate. He believes in what he's doing. Will we move forward with that investment? TBD. But for me, it was that. And the other thing for me, and you understand based on where you're from, where we're both from, what do I have to lose? What do you have to lose? The thing you have to lose is your ego. Someone says no to you. So you feel bad about yourself. So you're not. Someone tells you you're not good enough. Someone tells you, especially when you're from working class places, sometimes, you know, you're not a good fit. Who cares? You know, try again and again. Like, I've been told 90 times for every 10 yeses. Maybe probably that ratio is a lot worse. But I always ask, and I ask in the same way, a genuine way that's passionate and that's honest.
Yeah. So moving a little bit to mobility here, and this will probably be the last question. So before I go into this last question, Where can people find more information about Fondalis, about Chris Thomas, et cetera? Anything else you want to promote?
No, I mean, I think, really, really proud of the fact that Fondalis is the first firm in the world that was investing in this space. And given what mobility is today, it's remarkable. It's just unbelievable. And so I take a lot of pride. Detroit and Michigan should take a lot of pride that we can be one of the major hubs globally when it comes to the future of movement, when it comes to how we move the world. That's really exciting for me. I think there's two initiatives that I'd hold up just while I have this opportunity. I appreciate you giving it to me. One, I mentioned the Commit Foundation, amazing organization, national in scope, that helps current service members from all four branches who are transitioning to civilian life, amazing men and women who are looking for those that next opportunity in their professional life. And then the other organization, it's equally near and dear, it's called Read to a Child. So I was a national chairman of this organization for 3 years. I was on the Detroit board once. I've had to step off just because I have a young boy. I have one on the way. I'm reading to him every night. But I'm where I am because my parents read to me every night, and they gave me the same tools in the toolbox to compete from all my friends from Grosse Pointe and Birmingham and Ann Arbor and amazing places from around our country, around the world. And once I had those tools, I could compete. And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. But Read to a Child is focused on children grades 1 through 5, that you read to them during their lunch hour. And it just exposes kids who maybe aren't being read to at home or have that much exposure to literacy to gain a love of literacy and to gain the tools to go out there and do really amazing things. They're in Detroit. They're growing leaps and bounds. Our director here is a native Detroiter as well. She's unbelievable. I would highly recommend that. And if you want to meet me, we can just meet at Campus Martius. We can grab a beer over by the beer tent. Be great.
Awesome. So the Commit Foundation and Read to a Child.
Correct. Read to a Child Detroit.
Read to your child Detroit?
No, Read to a Child, but there's multiple cities, I just mentioned Read to a Child Detroit.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Read to a Child.
The whole organization is great, but I'm very passionate about Detroit.
Awesome. So last question here. So you are very well respected in the mobility space.
Thank you.
And last week I just came from a mobility summit in Ann Arbor, and one of the topics was, yes, mobility has a place in Detroit and the Detroit Ann Arbor Ypsilanti corridor.
Mm-hmm.
However, it would be inane to say that Detroit is the leader right now. It's not to say that we'll never be,
mm-hmm.
but right now Silicon Valley owns it.
Why do you say that?
I think because right now that's where all the dollars are invested.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, a lot of the talent is. However, it goes without saying that there is a sort of exodus on the coming, right? And so what, in your opinion, has to happen, or maybe what is necessary for the mobility industry in Detroit to position ourselves as that front runner?
Great question. So I think about this question all the time as it relates to what benefits our community and our city and our state, but how do we actually win? How do we not just try?
Right.
How do we not just go to a conference and talk about it, but how do we win in a tangible way? And so the two things you said, and I like what you said, are that, you look at where investment dollars are going, you look where talent resides. You can't deny, if you want a virtuous cycle, you need investment, you need talent, you need company creation and ideation, and you need that flywheel just to go. I believe, with all my bones, when you look at Metro Detroit, Detroit, without a doubt, is the largest transportation technology cluster in the world. And I've said for many years that our past and present position us perfectly to be the leading purveyor of mobility solutions around the globe. Not the only one. Our friends in Stuttgart, our friends in Tokyo, Silicon Valley, certainly they're going to win.
Right.
But when you look at the global auto and OEM ecosystem, everyone is here. When you look at manufacturing capacity, everyone is here. When you talk to guys from the most prolific industrial regions of Europe, they will say nothing, we can't compete with Detroit. That is a legacy asset that we can leverage in an amazing way.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't leverage it unless we have the talent and unless we have the dollars. So something that I recently announced with Jessica Robinson is a new organization called the Detroit Mobility Lab. This is an organization that its whole reason d'etre, the whole reason to exist, is to be focused on the creation of talent in Detroit and that Detroit can be the purveyor of the future of mobility. The first initiative that Detroit Mobility Lab is focused on is the creation of the Michigan Mobility Institute. And this thing is focused uniquely on creating talent in cybersecurity, AI, and robotics, and other industries that are going to be incredibly important here in the near term to ensure that that talent is not just brought here. And the exodus point is really important. We talk a lot about in this region, how do we get all of our this amazing talent from Palo Alto, from Pittsburgh, from around the globe here? How do we create it here? We have to ask that question as well. So that's something I think is really important. And that's something we're in the midst right now of just defining what exactly that looks like. And we decided to move forward with this announcement. There's a tendency, I think, especially on the part of Midwesterners, to want to have something that's completely baked before you put it out there, which is not a bad tendency. But sometimes you need to put an idea out that is half-baked, that has the bones, but now we have to put the meat on it.
Right.
That's something that I think is going to be incredibly important. We need that talent here. And then the last thing I'd mention is that, and this is breaking news here on our podcast. We announced this at the Mackinac during the Mackinac Policy Conference a couple weeks ago. Time's passing quickly. One thing that with our expanded working group that we're talking a lot about now is not just, we obviously required excellence when it comes to PhDs and entrepreneurs in AI, robotics, and cybersecurity and other fields. We also need to be very focused on the trades. How are we focused on individuals who are transitioning from jobs today, whether that's driving a heavy-duty truck across the country or whether that's other jobs that our dads had, like, you know, working class, working with your hands job. The people that are going to be purveying, or rather servicing the future of mobility, whether it be electrification, whether it be the dialing in of sensor suites, whether it be maintaining those vehicles from a fleet perspective, autonomous or otherwise, that are on the road through TNCs, that's a huge opportunity. We have a chance in Detroit not only to create those trades and create those jobs for individuals who are going to do great jobs there, because I believe that our engineers and our people in Detroit and in the Midwest in general are just fantastic. Mm-hmm. We have a chance to actually define what those accreditations look like. And that's something that I think there's not a lot of discussion around that, but there's going to be. So we're really excited about, again, I believe, being at the leading edge of what is it going to take not only to make mobility the space it can become, but to ensure Detroit's place in it. And the last point I'll leave you with is it's not a rightful place. This isn't something that's a birthright.
Right.
This is a huge opportunity we have to work really hard and go get something. Mm-hmm. And if we look at it that way, I believe we'll win.
Awesome. I love that answer. And with that, I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.